Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Have you ever wished you had a pool in your own backyard? Because you live in a condo, it's impossible. Like Airbnb before them, Swimply lets you rent a pool in your neighborhood by the hour. Well, Airbnb lets you rent a whole apartment, but Swimply, similar model. Creator Boonam Laskin is here to talk about how it works. And in particular, I want to know how the insurance works and the sanitizing. Then a closer look at open banking. So we've talked about this this phrase in a number of contexts over the years. What's the latest? What's going on with open banking here in Canada? Our guest, Andreas Park, professor of finance at the University of Toronto. And if you know anyone looking at getting a post-secondary education, you'll know that it's expensive. You'll know that many of them look for scholarships and bursaries to help pay for it. But that's a lot of work. There's a lot of schools. There's a lot of options out there. There is a platform called Scholarships Canada, and they endeavor to make that search a little easier for you. We're going to talk to Logan Wright, the managing editor at Scholarships Canada, to find out more about how it works. Plus, a new report from Prosper Canada looking into access to financial help for low-income Canadians. Spoiler alert, there are gaps, big gaps. Elizabeth Mulholland, CEO of Prosper Canada, will be here to take us through these latest findings. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. The swimming pool. On a hot summer's day, there is almost nothing better. And if you are lucky enough to own one, you love it when you're in it, amazing, but you can't be in it 24/7. So maybe, just maybe, you might want to use that pool for some extra cash. There is a company called Swimply that helps you rent out your pool by the hour, part of a broader trend over the course of the last 10 years that has brought us really the Airbnb of almost everything. First apartments, now cars, bikes, parking spots, and pools. Boonam Laskin is the creator of Swimply. He joins us now to talk about how it works. Hello there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Where did this idea come from? Did you just say, okay, Airbnb of everything, and you looked at your toaster and said no, and you looked at your winter coat and said no, and then you saw a pool and went, yes, that's it?
I want to say that it was a process of reduction, but it was actually kind of like a form of a survival at the time. I'm the oldest of 12. So I have 9 younger sisters and 2 younger brothers. And in the summer of 2018, my mother welcomed my youngest sibling to the family. And coming from a family that never really had much, we never really had the means to travel or send anyone away for camp, the moment summer hit, you can imagine all 12 of us under the age of 21 at the time in a 5-bedroom house was not super welcoming for everyone's sanity. But my neighbor built a pool, and she barely used it, and I kind of offered to help her with her expenses in exchange for my family using it when her grandkids were not over, which was often. And we started using it. Within 2 weeks, 5 other families were doing the same thing. I figured maybe I can help other people monetize their swimming pool.
And in your family, it wouldn't be just pleasure. I can imagine it being like a core part of mental health for 12 kids having that option.
For my mom, more than anyone, yeah.
Yeah. Who lifeguarded?
My mom and myself, actually.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So give us the essence. How does this work for the host? How does this work for the renter?
Yeah. So we make this for both sides, especially because it's so new. For the owner, it takes around 5 minutes. You have a swimming pool that you are very proud of, that you feel like you can make more use out of it and bring more joy to people. You visit swimply.com or you download our Swimply app on the iOS or Android store. You upload a couple of photos. The owners are in charge of all the rules. So how many people are allowed, how many kids are allowed, are kids allowed, are pets allowed? You decide your own price, when your pool is available, when it's not. It's your pool, it's your rules. We give you full control of how to run it. And then you're available for viewing by local swimmers. In the area, for swimmers, it's even easier. You put in your location, we'll show you pools nearby. You can filter by barbecue, having shallow areas, hot tubs, a lot of different amenities. And then once you find the perfect pool, you see exactly when it's available, and you book it by the hour. pools start from $25 an hour all the way to $200 an hour. Once you book it, you get an email of how to get in and how to get out. It's like an entirely self-serve process. And it's a win-win for everyone.
How do hosts ensure that their property is protected? And this is a question that the Airbnb of anything would be relevant for. We've Airbnb'd our house. It was largely good, but we had one really bad experience. I'm sure that's a question in the back of people's minds as they choose to put their pool on Swimply.
Absolutely. And I would say that we did our best to not reinvent the wheel on this one. As you mentioned, a lot of people came before us. And so obviously we have a two-sided review system. Every owner gets reviewed by every guest. Every guest gets reviewed by every owner after every experience. We do a lot of security checks on users. We also do provide protection on our own. So we do definitely step up and provide the necessary coverage to fill the gap. So we provide up to $2 million on liability coverage and up to $10,000 in property damage. What's really cool about Swimply is that it's all outdoors. So unlike, something like Airbnb where they're coming inside and there's a lot more potential exposure over here, it's all outdoors. It's the average amount of people are only 5 to 7 guests that come in, and the average experience is only 2 hours long. So even though we've put over 1 million people in people's backyards so far, it's been an extremely smooth experience.
Who cleans the pool?
The pool does majority of the work. It's kind of how they tend to be designed. And so that's another really cool thing about Swimply is that majority of the time, most owners don't even know that a guest was there. Maybe they leave a pizza box behind, and that's a rare occurrence.
Right.
And so the chlorine does 99% of the job. For larger events that people tend to host, the owners will tend to tackle on an additional cleaning fee.
Is the host usually home or not home at the time?
It's definitely a mix. At first, it was generally only owners that were not home. They were renting out the pool while they're at work. But there are a lot of owners in the platform that love the hospitality element of it all, and they actually greet the guests and give them a tour of all the areas, sign them up to the Wi-Fi, show them how to work the speaker.
Marco Polo. I would just be, please tell me you know that game. Come on, you got to know Marco
obviously.
Polo.
I'm kind of a guru when it comes to pool games at this point. So
I believe it. You must know all those games. If I were to host, I would have to prevent myself from getting too actively engaged in the way that activity came to be.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine a lot of owners probably have a lot of FOMO while they're renting out their pool.
Yeah, everybody's having such a great time. What are the rules in general on alcohol and drugs?
We make it entirely up to the owners. So we really... you can look at it almost like as a pool owner, we're giving you all the tools that you would need to rent out exactly what you're comfortable to and make sure that, you don't get any experiences that you're not comfortable with. There are pools in LA that advertise themselves as 420 friendly. We keep it entirely up to the owner, to decide what they want to host.
I was raised with a backyard pool, but when the heater broke, my dad just decided he wasn't going to fix it. So we were not a very popular destination in a Canadian summer without a heater, not super cool. But one thing my mom was nuts about was lifeguarding. If I were to rent out my pool, that would be in the back of my mind at all times, even if the insurance and liability was all taken care of. I just don't know how I would live with myself if an accident occurred on my property. How do you address that fear for hosts?
Absolutely. So, I mean, we do specify exactly on the, when you accept the reservation, who are the adults and who are the kids, who needs to be supervised. We do educate our swimmers pretty much on designating somebody at all times to be the one that is watching over the experience. What's really cool about Swimply is that because the experience is so limited to generally around 2 to 3 hours, majority of pool accidents happen from, distraction and people not supervising. But because it is limited to a short amount of time and because it's limited to a small amount of people, the engagement is always extremely high and the supervision is always extremely easy. So that tends to be the natural use case is just profoundly more safe than alternatives.
What are the economics for the host? So with all these other examples that we've talked about, there is a fee that goes to the Swimply equivalent. What's that fee in your case?
The owners keep 85% right now, and they charge whatever they would like.
Canada is a great pool country in certain parts of the country and at certain times of the year. I did go online. I see that Swimply is here and active. Is there any regional nuance that you have observed for Canada or for colder climates in particular?
Well, overall, I'd say Canada was a big surprise to us. We launched in Canada by accident, actually. Our first city was in New York. And then we just got so much demand from Canada that somebody there thought we already launched there. And so they said that we launched there. And so our demand was already coming so high, it tripled. And so we just decided to make it available overnight in the area. And it's grown to be one of our top 10 markets. And we're in 130 cities right now. So I'll say that Canada overall has been explosive, specifically Toronto, and this past year, Montreal as well. So I can't say that like we saw that coming so much, considering what you just mentioned of the weather and the time of year. But it sounds like when people can swim, they're going to swim at all costs. And this was a great solution for them.
What have you learned about the conversations that a pool owner needs to have with their neighbors? Because, again, Airbnb can be awesome for the host. It can be not so awesome for their neighbors sometimes.
Yeah, we actually have, we figured this out really quickly and really early on, considering this whole Swimply experience started with my literally next door neighbor. Mm. And then it was constantly being used by the neighbors nearby. And so it definitely has an influence on the neighborhood. In order actually to sign up as a host, you have to agree to we have a dedicated walkthrough of our neighbor-friendly policies, which actually mandate that you speak to your neighbor around how often you can rent out, how late you can rent out, how many cars they'll pool with, parking on the streets, and whatnot. So again, there's so much we can do as a platform other than educate everyone to the best of our ability. And then we give a portal for neighbors to report their neighbors who do not abide by our rules.
Does it include video upload capability?
We request it afterwards. So you report, you give us your address, you give us your neighbor's address, and you let us know if they had the conversation with you, if they did not have the conversation with you, and if they had the conversation with you and violated the rules.
So the neighbors could upload their creeping video of, oh my God, they're horrible. I can't believe they let this happen.
We tend to ask for that, actually. So if there's some incidents that are, something we would not be proud of accommodating on the platform, we will ask the neighbor to send us any videos that they have.
Right. With an apartment, there's controlled access by way of maybe a camera or a code. Most pools have a gate, maybe a lock. How does entry work for a renter?
This is actually why it worked so well, I would say, even during the pandemic. When you book a pool, 100% of our pools and 100% of pools that we've ever seen allow side entrance to the backyard, mainly because when people build a swimming pool, it is a social investment. And when you want to have friends over or throw a party for your kid, you don't necessarily want them all walking through your house. So the natural design of most pools is that people have access to the side entrance. Owners charge by tier, so 0 to 5, 5 to 10, 10 to 20, 20 to 30. And so it tends to, guests will tend to bring a guest or two extra or a guest or two less. And that's generally okay. The owners are home, around 60 to 70% of the time. So they're generally the ones, supervising how many people are there. And if guests do show up with more guests than they claim to have come with, then we actually have fines in place for that.
Right. And if they're not home, is it here's the keypad code to get into my backyard, or do you just leave the door open?
Even if they are home, that tends to be how it works. Go in through the left side, enter in 3, 4, 7, 8, and then walk in through the backyard and leave it as you found it.
As you know, this is a show about money. Do you find that your hosts, what is the order of priority in terms of their why? Are they doing it for the money? Are they doing it to be social? I mean, at $75 an hour in a Canadian summer, you'd have to be pretty booked in order for that to be a significant part of your income.
So they definitely start off, from what I've seen, and I've spoken to dozens of us at this point, MLF, it generally starts off with, hey, I'm spending so much on my pool. Let me just rent it out enough to for the pool to be free and maybe even pay for the heating and, if there's a cool renovation. So it generally doesn't even start about the money as much as having the pool pay for itself or upgrades. So they already have in mind what the money is going to go towards. And then two things either happen at that point. Either they become so extremely popular and they're starting to earn six figures, like several of our hosts, and it just becomes so simple and lucrative. Even if you want to be a casual host, you can earn $2,000 to $3,000 a month. So, and then they just become addicted just from the amount of money that they're earning, or they get addicted to the amount of joy they're providing. Around 1/3 of our owners say that one of their biggest motivators on and why they're so happy with Swimply is being able to just provide joy to people that don't maybe have the same access as them.
I can see that. Bunim, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Bunim Laskin is the creator of Swimply. It's oversimplified, but it really is an Airbnb of the backyard pool. If you've got one, you can make some money on the side. And if you want access to one, you can go online and see where a Swimply pool might be available near you. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, we're going to be talking with the CEO of Prosper Canada, Liz Mulholland. There's a new report on financial help gaps for low-income Canadians. They are yawning gaps. What can be done to close them? And later, we're going to talk about the future of open banking. Andreas Park is a professor of finance at the University of Toronto. He will be our guest. To stay up to date on all things Moolala, you can sign up for our newsletter. It is at moolala.ca. It has all the stuff that we do here on Sirius XM, CBC Radio, CityLine, BNN Bloomberg, all those kinds of places. And we will never, ever do anything with your email address. You can even come and use our pool. That's not true. We don't have a pool.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. A report from the national charity Prosper Canada has found that low-income Canadians are really struggling financially, this we know, but in part because of access. They've such a hard time getting access to the financial help that they need and that would make a real difference for them. This report is called Missing for Those Who Need It Most, Canada's Financial Help Gap. And we're going to talk about the findings and some of the ways that Canadians can address these issues with Liz Mulholland. She is the CEO of Prosper Canada. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. How are you?
I'm good. I want to start off by framing who we're talking about when we're talking about low-income Canadians. Paint us a picture of the income level and the circumstances that folks would find themselves in.
The statistics that we quote from are from a national survey by the Financial Resilience Institute, and they defined lower income as any individual or household with an income under $20,000 and multi-person households with an income under $50,000. So you're basically talking, if you've got more than one person in the household, income up to $49,999. If you're just a lone person, single individual, income under $20,000.
And having an income level, having income at that level in today's times of nuts inflation and crazy cost of everything would be a hurdle first and foremost. But there are also, and as this report highlights, a number of other barriers. Can you talk about some of the barriers that people at that income level would experience?
You know, they have very distinct financial context and needs that are different from middle and higher income people. So when your income is at that level, the odds are a good chunk of your income comes from government benefit programs, tax credits. So think of Canada Child Benefit or Old Age Security and Guaranteed Income Supplement if you're a senior, GST credit, Canada Worker Benefit if you're a younger working person who's getting some income support. So and that means that all of those programs come with rules and restrictions and thresholds, et cetera, and interactions that are quite complex to sort through and to navigate. And they also need to be applied for. You need a tax file to get that income support. So they have a lot of needs around this benefit system and navigating it safely, effectively, successfully to get their incomes up. But they also have to navigate the rules about, well, if you save too much money and your assets are too high, you lose access to that program, or suddenly you no longer get the housing subsidy or the childcare subsidy comes with that. So they're also, it has implications for what kind of savings vehicles they use for saving for retirement. So if your income is under $50,000, you should be saving in a tax-free savings account. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, when you retire, you're going to see all your seniors benefits get clawed back and you'll end up getting taxed much more heavily. But often when people go to the bank, their bank suggests to them it's RSP season. It's time for you to open an RSP. And they'll say, no, I want a tax-free savings account. And the 26-year-old at the bank doesn't realize that this is actually an RSP is a very bad thing for this person because of their income. They say, no, madam, RSPs are where it's at. Let me sell you one. And off they go to the races. They come out of the bank with an RSP and they're in the wrong savings vehicle. So we have this disconnect between having distinct financial circumstances and needs that really impact your ability to find relevant financial help by people who are knowledgeable about what they need, and mainstream financial information, advice, guidance, and stuff that's being sold to them that is designed for people who have very different needs. But often the people kind of promoting it aren't aware that this isn't right for these people. You shouldn't actually be doing this. And when they go to look for something that meets their needs better, they find there's very little on offer. And when we look at the private sector, which delivers many excellent financial help services for people with middle and higher incomes, there's no real strong business case, from a commercial sense, to actually design products and services for lower income consumers, because there are very few profit making opportunities, or to the extent they exist, are much smaller than the opportunities associated with higher income clients. So,
and they inherently need to be low touch because the profit margin per human is probably a lot lower. And so that maybe a digital intervention is the only thing that would make sense. But given the complexity that you've highlighted, harder for a human to take advantage of. There's one other quite intangible dynamic that you highlight in the report that I think is really relevant, and that is a lack of trust.
Yeah.
Why would that be? Why is that different for people with lower income than for people with higher incomes?
Yeah, I think one is that disconnect around, do they really understand me and what I need? And secondly, I think many people who are marginalized in our society have had experiences that are less than positive, I think, in their interactions with mainstream institutions and others. And so it might be because they have a visible disability. And, if you're a frontline service provider in a commercial banking establishment or a financial help service, you have targets and you've got to move stuff through, and you see a prospective client approaching who's going to take longer to serve because they have a disability or a language barrier, or they're very elderly. And we've had people tell us the instinct is to duck and hope they go to the other wicket, and then we've heard from people who, maybe they're sleeping rough, or maybe they don't look very nice, or their clothes may be very dirty because they don't have secure housing, or maybe they have a mental health problem, and they go in and the security guard takes one look and just cuts them off before they even get to the service personnel and ushers them out the door. And then other people have had people make judgments and comments to them about, it must be nice to sit at home and earn a welfare check every week, while the rest of us have to go to work every day, these types of things. So, and then of course, if you're racialized or indigenous, we have, everyday racism and attitudes that aren't what they should be that people experience. And the double whammy is really for people who are both low income and racialized, have told us that their experiences are often, can be negative, not across the board, of course not, but But the risk is higher that they will have had a bad experience that leads them, and they report that they're less likely to then talk to these mainstream institutions as a result. So
you outline 8 critical services for financial health, and I eyeball that list, and some of them I can see for higher income. Sure, a client is reasonably well served by a bank, but as we say, lower profit for someone who's lower income. These are things like conducting a comprehensive financial health assessment, helping to build a comprehensive financial plan, helping to develop and adhere to a budget and spending plan. Mm-hmm. What are the ways to provide those services for this population?
Yeah, I think we've seen that. You know, we've run large-scale pilots across the country of community-based service providers that work with low-income people every day who've been trained to provide these financial help services. And those have been very successful. We found out from third-party evaluations and the sites we ran in Ontario that, you know, over 80% of the people who use the service had received no financial help from any other source in the past year. If they access tax filing and benefit help, their incomes went up by quite a bit, on average about $3,600, and that they were achieving a financial outcome as a result of the service, even from very brief interactions. So, and over 95% would recommend the service to somebody else. So that tells us that the services were working, that they're needed, that they're relevant. I think we have other, CRA supports a national network of community tax clinics, which do great work. And, you know, we know CPA Canada and accountants have their tax clinics too. And these things are phenomenal. The problem is they only operate during the tax season. And if somebody is eligible for another $10,000 a year in income, if they can tax file, but there's no help on offer the rest of the year, do we really want them to wait a whole year? So I think some of these are, can we extend some of these services year round that are so good during the tax season? So, and then of course for debt help, we have great nonprofit credit counseling services, but probably not adequately supported, you know? So we need more of that service. And then we need ways to connect these services out and extend them out to rural, remote, and Indigenous communities who are often quite cut off from these services. You can find them in urban areas, but we're not finding, not all of them, but you're more likely, if they exist, to find them in an urban area. So how do we build relationships, leverage technology, build partnerships to really make sure that no matter where you live in Canada, you can connect into these services?
If I could snap my fingers, one of the things that I would do for this population is have these kinds of services available automatically, i.e. you don't have to be aware of them. You don't have to sign up for them. You don't have to show up for them. They're just there. And a great example in nonprofit credit counseling is a collection agency actually will do a warm referral to a nonprofit credit counselor. They're talking to a client on the phone. They will literally patch them through to a nonprofit credit counselor. What are the opportunities for the services to exist like you would expect in a hospital? If you've had a car accident, you don't have to then go and apply to get someone to search your head back together. You're there, you're presenting with this injury, and you kind of can just be in the flow of how that system unfolds.
You know what? It's a great question, Bruce. And I would say we already know that there are two questions that any service system could ask people, and they would know whether they needed financial help or not. The two questions are, have you tax filed in the past year if they're low income? And if you haven't, well, madam, can I connect you to a free community tax clinic service that can assist you, because it's likely you're not getting all the income that's available to you. The other question is, are you having trouble making ends meet at the end of the month? And if the answer is yes, well, you know, we can probably help with that. Would you like to meet with a financial counselor? Toronto Public Library offers free financial counseling in 2 branches. Can we make an appointment for you? You know, like, so I think in almost any human service system, you could build this into the intake system, but they need to have the relationships with community financial help providers, whether it's the free tax clinic, the credit counseling, the financial counseling service. And the problem right now is we don't have enough coverage or investment in those free financial help services to be able to refer people out to. But I know in Winnipeg, where they do have a great community financial help organization, Seed Winnipeg, and community financial counseling services working together, they've reached out to tens of organizations and municipal service providers, and they've taught them how to build these screening questions in, and they've built referral relationships. And so pretty much if you live in Winnipeg and you're low income, if you walk in to get a service anywhere, somebody's going to ask you, have you tax filed lately? And are you having trouble making ends meet?
Don't go anywhere. We're going to tax file right now.
Well, in Edmonton, they'll actually refer you to somebody on the spot who can help you with your finances if you go to get your free transit pass or your free recreation pass as a low-income person. So
let's get to that everywhere. Liz, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bruce. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Liz Mulholland is the CEO of Prosper Canada, and this report is called Missing for Those Who Need It Most, Canada's Financial Help Gap. There is much to be done, but there are lots of people like Liz who are working on this and working to improve things every day, everywhere.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later on the program, open banking. I'll talk to finance professor Andreas Park about some of the pros, the cons, the challenges, how that idea may unfold here in Canada. But first, Scholarships Canada is a website that helps people seeking post-secondary education navigate the thousands and thousands of scholarships and bursaries out there. I'll speak with managing editor Logan Bright. If you have missed an episode of the show, you can go to moolala.ca. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms out there. Download it, write a review, even subscribe.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
If you know someone heading off to university, to college, wherever, post-secondary somewhere, you might be looking at that cost and thinking, surely there is more help out there. You may be on the lookout for things like scholarships and bursaries. But there are a lot, and it can be really hard to find the right ones to apply to, find the ones that fit. Scholarships Canada is a platform that is trying to make that search easier for you, putting various scholarships online by school, et cetera. And so we're going to talk about how that works. Logan Bright is the managing editor with Scholarships Canada, and he joins us now. Hello there.
Hey there. Thanks so much.
So, how does the website work?
Yeah, great. So basically, Scholarships Canada is an index or a database of awards aimed primarily at Canadian students, though that's not hard and fast rule. What we do is our best to index awards from common and uncommon sources and lay them out in a consistent way that makes them easier to search and easier for our tech to sort of match a user to a given scholarship.
What is the info that you would ask the person applying for? I assume, you know, name, what program of interest, university of choice?
Yeah, there's almost a hierarchy to it, and you've nailed some of the big ones. And they're the ones that students are often sort of first thinking about, right? I want to study biology at the University of Carleton University. And okay, what do they offer? And that part is great, but what a lot of students and parents don't know is that there are awards for all sorts of other factors. So we dig a little deeper than just sort of field of study and location. into things like activities and affiliation, even sort of heritage or personal circumstances. Lots of big and little factors of any given person's unique biography that might connect them to an award, whether that's sort of ice hockey or skateboarding or ringette or vocal choir music, all sorts of different things.
How many are we talking about? Like, if I were to go and count every single scholarship that you had information on, what would it be? Is it 500? Is it 5,000?
Ooh, much more than either. We're talking tens of thousands. I don't have
really?
The exact. Yeah.
Wow.
Really. That's from many years of digging through and doing our best to sort of keep those up to date. So new ones.
How do you do that? How do you keep them up to date? I mean, we live in a world of AI. Do you have some sort of crawler that goes out and updates and adds new ones, or how does that work?
Yeah, great question. And the AI is something we're exploring but haven't implemented yet. We do it the old-fashioned way with a small team of remote editors, as well as a couple of on-site folks who we sort of assign to a given project or sphere, you might say, that they will then hit Google company websites, school websites, et cetera, and dig through what's available and add them through the sort of proprietary portal that we've built on the back end.
What's the dollar value on range here? So I can imagine some are like, wow, it's a $1,000 entrance scholarship for a BIPOC student from the Maritimes would be, I completely made that one up. But then there are ones that are probably much, much higher than that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the numbers we crunched last year had our average or median award amount around 2,500 Canadian. But you're right, a lot of awards are in that sort of $1,000 range. But some are even smaller than that. You might see small awards for 250 or 500 bucks from maybe a community organization. And we encourage students kind of not to turn their nose up at them because $500 here, $250 there can add up. And it's certainly preferable to slugging out those hours on a sort of minimum wage job. On the flip side, though, there are some awards that are $10,000 and above. The higher the dollar value, the more sort of competition you're likely to encounter. Canada in particular doesn't offer too many sort of full ride scholarships, quote unquote, but there are a few really massive programs of $60,000, $70,000, $100,000 a year. But again, you've got to be really the cream of the crop if you're going to snag one of those.
Now, I can imagine that this is the kind of service that some sort of government body would support. You're not that. How do you make your money?
Yep. You're right. We're a private or outfit. We've got ads on the site that any user will see. We also have what we call featured scholarships. So these are sort of advertisement placements from universities or companies who are looking to get more eyeballs on a particular listing. So whether that's the award is undersubscribed or it's brand new, they're trying to get the word out. We've got the reputation and the audience to sort of make that connection. So we will sort of promote specific awards with our audience as well on the homepage, as well as some emails that we'll send directly to students to let them know. But crucially, the site itself is entirely free for students, counselors, parents, anybody to use, as long as you're okay with ads or have an ad block.
What did the application requirements look like? And I ask because in the world of job search, it used to be hard. You'd see a classified ad, you'd write up a customized cover letter, you'd send them their resume, your resume, and then they'd vet from there. In the world of Indeed.com, you can push like one button, two buttons, and the employer is flooded with applicants. Is there some gating when it comes to scholarships? Are there things that you need to do so that they're ensuring that at least you're in the game before you apply?
Yeah, it really depends on the award, and it goes kind of back to the admin's goals in a lot of cases, whether they are looking for maximum volume of applicants or whether maybe they'd want fewer actual applicants of a very particular quality. So it does depend on the program. Broadly, we are seeing some of the sort of Indeed-esque application platforms coming into vogue. We have one, other outfits have them, where we can host the actual program, to handle all of the documents sort of internally and make subsequent applications easier. So we are seeing some of that, as well as Google Forms. SurveyMonkey's got a similar thing. So it really depends on the scholarship admin. A lot of folks are looking for sort of how would this award impact you and your community type essays or personal statements, videos, that kind of thing. So we offer advice to students on how to craft a sort of boilerplate personal statement and essay and reference letter, one or two, so that when they find that award that requires something like that, they're prepared to apply and not trying to pull all that stuff together from scratch.
Well, I was going to ask you, tell us a bit more about some of the other resources that you offer. So you've got the screening tool or the finding tool for these scholarships and bursaries. What else?
That is the big selling point, of course, being able to filter or get matched to the specific awards. We've got a regular email, a sort of monthly reminder of deadlines that are coming up soon. So if I've matched to X, Y, and Z, I can get an email reminding me, hey, you know, the deadline for Z is coming up pretty soon. Don't forget about it. So that we find is pretty handy, and that's all on top of more standard advice type material, examples, FAQs, sort of if you don't know what a bursary is, here's the definition, here's why you might apply for one as opposed to a scholarship. So trying to really make the whole process more accessible and understandable, comprehensible to users, some of whom are, you know, from outside of Canada and aren't necessarily familiar with our system. Many people here are not even.
I'm laughing because let's pretend I totally know what the difference is between a bursary and a scholarship. But for those out there in our listening audience who may need a bit of a refresher on the difference between those two things, how would you articulate the difference between a scholarship and a bursary?
Yeah, so scholarship gets thrown around as a somewhat generic catch-all term for money for school. More specifically, a scholarship is sort of based on achievement, often academic, sometimes sort of volunteer, sports-based in the States especially. Bursary, by contrast, has a more specific meaning, and that is related to financial need. So a bursary is explicitly for folks who have a gap in their financing, whether that's an emergency or, you know, sort of chronic. Bursaries are financial aid based specifically, not grade or achievement based. So that's the broad distinction there. We could get deeper into the weeds on sort of subtypes of these things, but maybe that's better for the website.
Really interesting stuff. Logan, thank you for taking the time to explain it for us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having us, and have a great afternoon.
Logan Bright, Managing Editor at Scholarships Canada. So if you are a student, if you know a student, point them to this kind of filtering tool, and I bet they will learn something new that they didn't even know existed. Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to talk about open banking, what it is, how it works, how Canada stacks up not well versus other countries around the world. Our guest is Andreas Park. He is a professor of finance at the University of Toronto. In addition to Moolala on SiriusXM, I am also the money columnist for CBC Radio. So every Wednesday afternoon, we focus on a topic relevant to you and to your financial life. So you can tune into CBC in the afternoons as well.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Open banking If you've never heard the term before, we're going to explain it for you. If you have some sense of what it is, it kind of sounds like the promised land, right? Like you've got control over your data. You can connect simply across multiple institutions. It's a dream, but how does it work? And when here in Canada are we actually going to see it? For more on the definition, the possibilities of future banking or of open banking here in the future in Canada, we're joined by Andreas Park. He is professor of finance at the University of Toronto. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
What does the term open banking mean for you?
So it is a bit of a mouthful, but the general idea is that financial institutions are required or offer a so-called API, that means application programming interface, which allows a third party service provider to access the data at a bank or at the financial institution so that they can offer a client or a customer some services.
And what are some of the benefits of that technological change to a client?
Well, you mentioned some earlier. So let me give you an example. So most of us have various savings accounts. We have maybe an investment account with an investment advisor. We may have maybe an account at a cryptocurrency exchange. We have insurance and so on and so forth. And you can imagine that a service provider goes out and collects and collates all of that information and gives you a full sense of what your financial health is, what kind of risks you're facing, and where there's some shortcomings. That's quite important, you know, for people who are later in their life and who want to, I mean, later meaning people over 30 who want to plan for retirement and to need to make sure that they are not exposed to a particular type of risk, for instance.
How does this technological change differ from what's currently available in the marketplace where a site can scrape that information? You give it your password and it can go and find the account balance at another account and the number of shares of a particular stock. So that information is somewhat available currently. How is that different?
Well, the most basic difference is that with screen scraping, as you describe it, you have to do this on a one-off basis. So you have to log into each account separately, and it's only done when you actually perform the action. Whereas a genuine open banking application would be able to do this on an ongoing basis. Now, this isn't just one example, of course, right? So the information, the idea of that you can collect all of your information, you could use open banking and fintech providers for a large variety of other things. Let me give you an example from the UK, for instance. So one of the things that, and not everybody may find this palatable, but I think it's a real problem, is that the elderly are often subject to scams and frauds. And oftentimes, so they're really targeted by criminals. And so one of the problems is that the elderly, when they get targeted from a fraud, they're actually not willing to accept it or to admit it, or they take their time to act on it. And so in the UK, there's a service where children can have alerts sent to them if there's large money movements on their parents' bank accounts so that they can have a lookout for their parents' financial health, if you want.
Interesting. So for countries that are further ahead than Canada, what have been some of the insights on the competitive landscape? Because we know here in Canada, there's like a big five or six banks, some big credit unions, and that's kind of the choice. There's a bunch of fintechs that augment that, but not a lot, versus the US, where there are thousands and thousands and thousands. How does open banking shift the competitive landscape?
Well, to be clear, the U.S. is sort of in a bit of a quagmire. They're still not that far ahead when it comes to these types of solutions. They're following more of a market-based approach where some banks start to offer it, and then they're hoping that others are following. I think the strongest example for open banking is the U.K. because they mandated it legislatively. So some of the things that you see is that there's just a large number of new services that are available to people. If for instance, when I go out and ask my students and I teach a class on fintech, is what do you want from your bank? What kind of services do you expect? And my students very quickly come up with any number of ideas that none of our banks provide, like budgeting, proper budgeting, putting money aside into various different pockets and so on and so forth. And all of these tools are available essentially in the UK. You know, there is a large variety of how you can manage your finances and what you can do with your money.
What is the current sense from Ottawa in terms of their interest in open banking, their appetite for regulatory change? How long do you think it will be until we start to see some real progress on this front?
Well, I'm not going to hold my breath. I would hope that at some point we kind of start getting a move on. Essentially, the Liberal government had promised us this in the 2015 campaign when they came to power first, that they would have open banking. But, you know, keep in mind, the Canadian Bankers Association is dead set against it. Because you see, the problem of, or the principle of Canadian banking is nobody comes between me and my customer. Right. And essentially what fintechs and what open banking applications would do is precisely that. They would come between the customer and the financial institution. So I would imagine that there's very intense lobbying going on in Ottawa against open banking. And I think that sort of partly explains why we have not seen this. I do want to say, so one of the first things that we actually need as prerequisite is almost that we have real-time payments, which is something we still don't have in Canada. And just as a tidbit of information, we've had the so-called Payments Modernization Initiative, which has been going on since 2012. And we still have not seen any meaningful result for the consumer of this whole initiative. And if I can throw one more tip at you,
yeah.
Because that's really exciting. Brazil, which is, you know, I wouldn't say, I mean, it advances as an economy, but I would like to think that they're behind us. It's much bigger than us, has many more banks. They've been able to pull off a real-time payments solution, which has an uptake in Brazil of 70% of the population within 9 months at a cost of $5 million. So when our banks tell us it's a $1 billion investment, it's really, really hard to do, it's just simply not true.
And what did they do? Did they make a deal with the devil? How did they pull it off?
Well, how did they pull it off? It's a good question. So they actually set up a very clever system by which, you know, people could use an existing bank account, register with the central bank, and that allowed them to access a particular type of system, which allowed real-time payments. And then they forced the financial institutions to sign on to it.
Sounds very simple. When you look at the consumer, so we're a show about money. We focus very clearly on the consumer. Is there anything from a cost-saving standpoint that they could hope to see down the road? I can see the efficiency. I can see the fraud prevention. I can see the value of having the big picture at your fingertips. Could it reduce bank fees? Could it reduce the annoying Interact e-transfer charge?
Yeah, so
that is a very interesting laugh. That is like a knowing laugh. That laugh says many things that have yet to be articulated.
Well, I gotta say, I moved to Canada in 2003, and I was really quite shocked considering how many bank branches you see everywhere in the country, how far behind we were. And that's 2003. And, you know, we are still unbelievably behind in terms of innovation in financial services. And, you know, also keep in mind, the Canadian customer is incredibly lucrative. So the second most lucrative market in the world is, I think, is Japan, where Japanese banks make about $500 to $600 a customer per year. Whereas in Canada, the Canadian banks on average extract something on the order of $1,400. So almost three times the amount from the customer. And it comes in so many different levels. It starts with payments. We all paying back the fees that we have from using credit cards and the like and debit cards. You know, a bank account in Canada is very expensive, considering that we're giving our money as deposits for free for the bank to lend out, right? And you know, there's a lot of different areas, but I think most importantly would be one, and this is kind of dear to my heart, is that just people would just have more control over their finances, have a better view of their finances, and would just have a better way to manage their lives with the right tools available to them.
What are the connections between open banking and Bitcoin, blockchain, crypto, money laundering, other things that we talk a lot about in terms of big themes that affect the system?
Good question. So I would look at them separately. I think open banking is really more of the interaction on the consumer level that you as a consumer can use what you already have in the existing world. Get financial services better. I see blockchain, I'm forgetting Bitcoin, but let's say blockchains like Ethereum, probably the most, the biggest invention that came out of Canada since insulin. I see that more of an infrastructure as a big financial infrastructure. It can do a lot of different things beyond, let's say, consumer banking. And, you know, I don't really see the direct relation there. It could tie in with this very nicely. So fun fact, Ethereum actually has everything in Ethereum is based on accounts. The size of the account in terms of number of characters, they're set up to be exactly the same as the European banking standards for account numbers. So it's the same length. Hmm. So it essentially could directly tie in if so desired. And then I forgot, what was the third thing that you mentioned?
Money laundering.
Oh, money laundering. Well, you know, money laundering and open banking, that's really not, I can't see that there is a relation. You already go through, you know, a KYC process. There are very firm standards and laws that have to do with how payments and money flows and what has to be reported when. That actually applies really quite broadly. I don't see that open banking would cause a problem there.
Just as we wrap things up here, you mentioned how far the UK was ahead of Canada. What can be learned from how open banking evolved there that could affect how it might evolve here? Was there a groundswell of consumer support? Was there leadership that was able to build bridges between the financial services sector and government? What really made the difference?
So the origin is slightly different. You know, after the financial crisis in 2008, people were incredibly dissatisfied and angry at the banks in the UK. You know, they engaged in some pretty callous behavior. And so therefore, the government had a very easy time convincing the general population that, you know, having an open banking solution is necessary in order to gain back some control from, you know, these monstrous organizations. We don't have the same sentiment here in Canada. And I think this is one of the reasons why there's no political will to actually do anything about it. So I think this is, they just started from a very different point. The other thing that is actually noteworthy is that we like talking about this, and you know, obviously I'm somebody who is pro innovation. I like to see things happen, but the uptake in the UK is not super dramatic in the sense of that all the banks and all the income is sort of going away. It's, I think in the population about 30-40% only actually have access to an open banking type product.
Interesting, very interesting stuff, Andreas. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Andreas Park, Professor of Finance at the University of Toronto. He was here to talk about open banking, what it is, how it could work here, and some of the dynamics that might lead to more Canadian enthusiasm for something that is an eventuality, I think. That's it for our show for today. A big thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. And to get in touch with us, comments, questions, story ideas, feedback, I don't know, open banking applications. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. You can subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca, the website, and to our podcast at any of the various podcast platforms out there. On social media, I am at Bruce Selry on Twitter, at least for now, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.